Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At first glance, Charlotte is bright, shiny, and new. It is often a challenge to find older buildings, historic buildings, structures that tell newcomers where the city has come from and remind natives of the city's past. Some of the old remains, but it is a battle to preserve what came before when the city's growth is dictating a better use for space, and I'll put the better in quotation marks. Many may even ask why we'd want to preserve certain structures. They've always been here. They've outlived their usefulness to contemporary society, so why not just tear them down, move on? Because a mix of the old and new gives a place character. It confers a sense of place. Some would say old places are the soul of a city. That's what Tom Mays would tell you, and I'm sure he will at some point in our conversation. He is Chief Legal Officer and Senior Counsel for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, but his roots are right here. Tom Mays is a Mecklenburg County native. He grew up in Huntersville, and he's back in town to participate in Charlotte's Historic Preservation Awards ceremony tonight at the Charlotte Museum of History, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome home.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to be here. Happy to be back home.
Nice to have you here. You're based in Washington now, which is my old stomping ground, so we'll have some things to talk about there, too, I suppose. And also in our Spirit Square studios, Adria Vogt. She is president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good to see you. You can email us if you have things to say to us or questions to ask at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. Okay, so you're a Charlotte native. You've been away for a while, but you're back for this event. Talk about what happened here, or didn't happen here in some cases, because Charleston, South Carolina preserved itself or re-upped itself because they went through a period where it wasn't so hot, and then they revitalized the historic area of Charleston, so they're reaping all the benefits. You can find a mix of old and new in places like Greenville, South Carolina. You can find it in Durham. You can find it in Columbia, Asheville. We have historic places here, but they're hard to find, and they seem separated from the rest of the gleaming office towers. Why?
Well, that's an interesting question to look back at the past and think about what happened to preservation in Charlotte in particular. You know, when I think about it, I usually think that it falls on the leadership of who was around, who chose to preserve or not. And in the cities that you mentioned, almost always there were a handful of people who cared deeply about preservation and who chose to keep the places and fight to keep the places. It was certainly true in Charleston, where the leaders of the Charleston Renaissance, who were largely artists and cultural people, fought to save those places. Charlotte, as you know, had a different culture that was more about banking, about industry, about manufacturing. And I don't think that the leadership, until more recently, necessarily thought that things were worth saving.
Did we? Well, that leads me to this, because when you it's easy to look at Charleston. It's easy to look at Georgetown. It's easy to look at Old Town Alexandria and places like that and say, well, yeah, those are great places because they're old and they've been revitalized, and it gives the city character, and you know what it used to be and what it is today, and there's history there. But does it take a visionary to recognize in the moment that that's a building, if we had more buildings like that, if we kept more buildings like that, that would accomplish here what has been accomplished elsewhere?
Sure. So one of the things I often say is preservation is, in a way, the march of the ugly turning into the beautiful. Mm. So people often don't appreciate buildings that have not been well cared for or are at that moment in time when people think they're just dated. So, you know, you think about Victorian buildings. Victorian buildings, even in my lifetime, were considered ugly. and now we think of them as being beautiful. Or Art Deco, the same way.
Miami, or mid-century modern.
Absolutely. Mid-century modern, even brutalism, maybe postmodernism. Already we're beginning to think about the preservation of those buildings. And, you know, we are the field where we have the vision to see what those buildings might be and how they could actually be beautiful and be used.
A lot of the infill going up in places, and we'll talk about infill and the impact of infill on neighborhoods and historic preservation, but a lot of it, the new homes that are going up are, would you call them shaker style, or what would you call them? Because they look like old bungalows from the 1930s on steroids, because they're enormous. But we have embraced that as a look in Charlotte. Is that by design, or is that because of demand of a certain age group that's buying these houses? What's that all about?
I think a lot of it's driven by the market. That's one of the reasons why we're excited to host the Historic Preservation Awards and shine a light on infill projects that are sensitive to the nature of the historic neighborhood. So you don't have that one anomalous structure that really sort of just ruins the cultural
but
landscape.
But we do. We have everything from Frank Lloyd Wright to something that looks like it belongs in the suburbs of Beverly Hills in some of our neighborhoods. Students sometimes view history as dark and dusty and detached from their lives. I see no use for it. Why do I have to know what happened in 1685? Why do I have to know that? When you're surrounded by history, or at least when you experience history through your surroundings, does that change that viewpoint? Are people more engaged with their past, or do they just continue to take it for granted? Or just building.
One of the things that I often say is it's great for people to experience history in the place where history happened. So I've had people say to me, I couldn't understand this Civil War battle until I went to the battlefield, because I could suddenly understand from the lay of the land the way one group of troops survived and another died. When you're in an old place, and the example I usually use is Old Salem. I remember going to Old Salem as a school child, and I remember vividly a woman, one of the interpreters, singing a cappella in this low, vaulted, plastered room. Mm. And then they served us that Moravian sugar cake. And I will remember that for the rest of my life. I have this sense about Moravian history, about freedom of religion, about why they came there. And that visceral experience of being in the historic place made history come alive. And I think that you'll find that often the only history people remember from their grade school years is the field trips, mm-hmm. because they had that visceral experience of history with all of their senses.
That's absolutely our experience at the Charlotte Museum of History. We steward Mecklenburg County's oldest home. It's a 1774 rock house of the Alexander mm-hmm. family.
Yep.
And we have field trips almost every day. And for generations, Charlottians have identified revolutionary history in their own backyard through this field trip experience, through this immersive experience, through the only building remaining in Mecklenburg County that's concurrent with the Revolutionary War. So a lot of people think, oh, we don't even go back to the Civil War, right? But we have all of this history that goes back to the Revolutionary War and even further for thousands of years.
There are people, when they go on vacation, who only go to the beach. They only go to Myrtle Beach or someplace like that. But then there are others who go to Rome and to Paris and Charleston in South Carolina and other places of historic value because they want to be immersed in the old and learn about what came before. What is that about some people? Some people like that. Some people want nothing to do with it.
And in terms of heritage tourism, I think there are demographics that probably it does not appeal to, but I think that's one of the great treasures of Tom Mays' book, Why Old Places Matter, because he's talking about relevancy and relevancy in terms of a younger audience. So touching on themes of sustainability and economic development and even minimalism, if you will. So embracing the mill home rather than the McMansion. So there's a lot of themes in this book that touch on things that might appeal to younger generations rather than strictly just going to visit a historic site for, you know, in terms of heritage tourism.
But there's a subset of those people who go to Rome and Greece and see things that are ancient. I mean, what struck me the very first time that I went to Rome was, because I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, which is like Charleston in terms of, at least as a section of it that's like Charleston. It's old. We don't know old in America. When you realize that some of these places are 2,000 and 3,000 years old in Europe. But we go there and we enjoy them, and we go there in part to see them, to experience them, and yet we come home and don't recognize the value of what's around us. Why don't we make that connection?
Well, I'm often puzzled about why we don't make that connection. I mean, part of it is purely a failure to see the deep history that's actually around us. So, for instance, Americans often think about our history only beginning in 1607 or in 1620. Mm-hmm. And yet that completely ignores the long, deep Native American history. And that's purely a sort of cultural perception about our history and how long it is. And there's certainly Native American sites here that should be appreciated, and some of which are state parks here. But, you know, it's interesting to think about Rome in particular. And as you know, I wrote many of the essays while I was living in Rome. One of the things that surprised me a little bit about people living in Rome is how lightly they wear their history. They simply live in that place, surrounded by their history every day.
Yep.
And I don't think that they... People talk about history as a burden, but they don't seem to feel that way about it. And I think it's an interesting sort of sense of freedom that they have to be surrounded by these historic buildings, use them every day, and not have to feel like it's a burden.
The essays that you just referred to are in the book that Adria referred to that you wrote called Why Old Places Matter, How Historic Places Affect Our Identity and Well-Being. But these essays, as I understand it, started as blog posts.
That's right.
What made you want to write them?
Well, for about 15 years, I taught historic preservation law at the University of Maryland. And I would begin every course with a discussion with my students about why we have historic preservation law. And very quickly, the conversation would turn to, why do we have historic preservation at all? And I discovered that my students didn't seem to have ready answers. They would use the phrases that are almost simple catchphrases, like, well, it's important to save our history, or save our heritage, or it's important for preserving property values, essentially the very ideas that are embedded in our statutes and laws.
Okay.
So I decided and thought that until we had a more articulate way to express what I thought was a very deeply held sense of connection between people and old places, we were unlikely to have stronger laws and policies, that we needed to be able to express these reasons to build an ethic of historic preservation. So I began to ask people about reasons and collect them. And I discovered that there really weren't very many places where you could find a lot of reasons connected together in one publication. So through the National Trust for Historic Preservation and the generosity of the American Academy in Rome, mm-hmm. I went off to go think through these ideas. And the result is this book that tries to capture 14 of the reasons.
Which we'll talk about. Tom Mays, or Thompson Mays, as the cover of the book says, is our guest. He's the chief legal officer at the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about historic preservation, the need for it, why Charlotte has done a so-so job of it, and what we've lost and what still remains and what still remains to be done. With us is Thompson Mays. He is the chief legal officer and senior counsel for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, but he is a Huntersville native. He's back home because tonight at 6, the Charlotte Historic Preservation Awards will be taking place at the Charlotte Museum of History, where Adria Vogt is president and CEO. She is also with us. The name of Thompson May's book, which has not only historic places that you know that because they're famous worldwide, but also places around Mecklenburg County, which is kind of an interesting thing, kind of an interesting mix. His book is called Why Old Places Matter, How Historic Places Affect Our Identity and Well-Being. I once said on this program, Adria, that Charlotte has torn down all of its history. And before I could get the words out of my mouth, historian Dan Morrill was whipping me with a wet noodle. He's taking me to task, adamant that we have, in fact, saved some significant places and continued to do so. But you say that this city has a lack of what Thompson Mays just talked about, a lack of a preservation ethic. What does that mean?
So I think that, to be fair, we have had a lot of triumphs in historic preservation in Charlotte, and we should be proud of a lot of those things. The Historic Districts Commission, Dan Morrill, with the Historic Landmarks Commission, and individuals in this community and organizations have done a lot to preserve our history here. So we should be proud of the triumphs that we have had. I do think there's a lot of room to improve our preservation ethic in Charlotte, and that's a big reason why we're hosting these preservation awards, to celebrate the success stories, both in infill and
historic. We have it. We have a lot of newcomers here, so they don't know our history, but they, some of them want to know it and want to look for it, and they can't find it. There are a lot of natives here. For a long time, we were pretty homogenous. Mm-hmm. So why didn't they appreciate? Were they too close to the forest to see the trees? Is that what it was?
I think that is a lot of the instance. People don't see what's right around them. That's why we partner with UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute on the city walks every May to get people out into their neighborhoods and exploring those historic neighborhoods, districts, and structures right in their own backyards.
Because Tom, you just said, because you lived in Rome for a while, that the people over there don't see it either, but it's still there. They don't tear it down. So if we do, when a building gets 50 years old in America, it's time to replace it in many cases. And I'm curious whether that has to do with our lack of appreciation for the old, the desire for the new, bright and shiny bauble in front of us, or does it have more to do with 30-year mortgages and tax depreciation schedules?
Well, that, you really put your finger on it, I think. I do think that there's a generational cycle that happens. Where a new building is built, it's fresh and shiny and new, and then it goes through that mortgage cycle. It goes through suddenly feeling dated, and people don't appreciate it at that moment in time. I included in the book images of Eastland Mall, which, of course, was the mall of my junior high school years. And that was because at the time I was writing this essay on identity, my cousin Stuart sent me images from the mall that the commission was having taken in anticipation of it being demolished, to document it before it was demolished. And these photographs were hauntingly beautiful. Mm. And I was moved by them. But what stunned me even more was that a preservation group had sprung up to save the mall. And this this surprised me, of course, because it was the mall of my junior high school years. And they were using the same language I was using about identity, about memory. And in fact, I believe that the man hired to demolish the mall actually set up a memory site on his website so that people could share their memories of the mall, because he had met his wife ice skating at the mall. And this really led me to think about how old is a building before it becomes old. And the result of thinking about Eastland Mall was the idea that people start to form attachments to a place, And those attachments become collective, where a lot of people share memories of a place in about 30 or 40 years, where there were all these people talking about the importance of Eastland Mall. I was seeing how beautiful it was, and people sprang up to try to save it, to preserve their memories and their sense of identity.
I want to repeat that these photographs of Eastland Mall and other places around Mecklenburg County are in a book that also includes pictures of the Colosseum in Rome, of the Pantheon in Rome, various historic ruins from around Europe, which we look at and think, that's history. We don't look at Eastland Mall and say, that's history. But it is. It's ours.
It is.
But is our history lesser then? Because when you think about the Colosseum in Rome, that was one of the seven wonders of the world. Was Eastland Mall?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say Eastland Mall was one of the seven wonders of the world, and wouldn't
you
could go pretend
ice skating
to. But you know, I think about these places, regardless of whether they're the Colosseum or Eastland Mall, it's about what meaning they have for us today and for the future. So people tend to think of historic preservation as being about the past, and it's really only partly about the past. It's about providing that bridge between the past, the present, and the future. So it's really about how to make our lives better now and in the future more than it is about that past.
So your book title, your subtitle, proclaims that historical places affect our identity. And you can see that in places like Boston and Philadelphia and Washington, Richmond, Charleston, Savannah, places like that, where history has been preserved and where our national identity has been preserved. And that preservation, that history is encapsulated in what has been preserved. It's in those pieces of architecture, in those buildings. You take it a step further. You say that the places we choose to save or not reflect our identity. Are you saying that the choices we make, save this, don't save that, define us?
Absolutely. One of the ways...
Well, how do you make that decision?
Well, that's challenging. Usually it is a shared community decision in some way. Sometimes the community doesn't have the opportunity to weigh in as much as I think they should. And often it's really left to the owner of the property to decide. And let me be clear, the majority of historic preservation activity throughout the country takes place because individuals simply choose to do it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the public has a vested interest in what survives or what doesn't survive. So when I returned to Charlotte, and coming over here, for instance, I drove down Tryon Street from out near the university.
When was the last time you were here?
I was here in March.
Okay. Right.
I was here in March. But I usually am visiting family and up around northern Mecklenburg more than coming to downtown Charlotte. I was delighted to see that I recognized a lot of things as I came through. So we think of Charlotte as not having old places, but I passed by Sugar Creek Church and then Rosedale and eventually came by the old Sears building. I came by the old Guthrie apartment building where my great aunt lived. So I could still recognize this place that I grew up with, and it conjured the memories of coming downtown with my parents, of visiting with my great aunt, and going to Sugar Creek Church, and being able to recognize those places and have that memory is really important.
You're experiencing one of the 14 things that you talk about in your book. You have listed these 14 reasons why old places matter, and one of them is that it takes only a generation, you say, before people form a sense of identity with a place. So people who grew up in the Carolinas have fond memories of the Pavilion, in Myrtle Beach, in Charlotte, you've already mentioned Eastland Mall. You've mentioned a couple of other places that were particular to you and your personal history and your time in Charlotte. We've torn a lot of that down. The Pavilion is gone. Eastland Mall is certainly gone. And yet the Tower of London is still there. The Bastille in Paris is still there. Are there any equivalencies there? I mean, these when you think of those buildings versus our buildings, when you look at some of these old structures in Europe, and then you look at a mill in Gastonia, and you think, it was a mill. Let's put a shopping center there.
Oh, well, if you want to talk about mills, the mills are our history.
Okay.
Our identity.
That's what I wanted to hear.
That's exactly right. I mean, the Luray Mill in Gastonia, which Preservation North Carolina has worked on for many years with a host of partners, highly significant not only for the memories of that community and for the way it formed the community, but also literally for nationally significant history. And that history is present here, and we should view those mills as being, in some ways, our equivalent to the Bastille.
But does it matter that they've just opened some things up in northern, somewhere over there. It's a great big mill complex, which has now, I think, become condominiums or apartment complex. When you take an old building like that, that has history because of what it was and how it functioned in the community of its time, and then you make it into an apartment building or a condo, or you put shops in the first floor and lofts in the second, what have you done to the history of that building?
Well, you've preserved it.
Mm-hmm. But to what end? It's no longer what it was.
But the memory is still there. So historic preservation has embraced adaptive reuse for, you know, many, many, many decades. And that is simply finding a new use for a building where that community interest in it, memory and identity, is still preserved, even though the use may be changed. Mm-hmm. So you may be trying to get to the idea of, you know, how is that still an authentic representation of a textile mill?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a reasonable question, and I think it's worth looking at how do you make sure people who continue to use that building also understand the history of it in a deeper way and the difficulty of working in a textile mill, the challenges of it, how hard it was, the health risk of it. That part of the history is preserved here in exhibits, and things like that, but should also, I think, be remembered more through storytelling at the site and through trying to interpret that site. But I don't want to miss the fundamental idea that if the place remains, it's a whole lot easier to tell that story and to remember that history. And that is actually where we came from.
Plus, it seems to me, maybe these old mills have different associations for people who worked in them than they do for the millennials who are living in them now. But we talk about these old buildings, the blend of old and new, giving a place character. There's more to it than that. It makes you feel good somehow. I don't know why. I can't explain why. But you're walking past this old building, and then there's a gleaming skyscraper right next to it. You think, yeah, why?
Couple answers to that. First, I think people sense time. And they, when they see a building that has wear or a certain type of texture, they read that intuitively. And having that sense of time makes them understand their place in time. It gives them a sense of continuity and a deeper sense of their place in the world.
It's another of your 14 points.
That's exactly right. I'm trying to get them all out eventually. a part of the end of the book is things that I'm continuing to look at since the book came out. And some of that has to do with our new capacity to measure people's experience of place in real time. through biometrics, by seeing how their body literally reacts to places through their pulse going up or going down, through their sweat glands being activated or not, or even mobile EEG technology, which measures how their brain responds to place as they are experiencing place.
This is worse than Google.
Right. You know, everybody's wearing Fitbits. Be conscious of the data you're giving through the Fitbit. But the interesting thing is that, and these studies are mostly preliminary and early, but they do tend to point to a direction that would reinforce some of the things that preservationists have thought for a long time. People do respond well to texture, the brick walls of an old mill building.
Patina that you can see people have lived and felt and been a part of.
Right. Exactly. People do actually respond to that, as you described.
That's why you say it affects our well-being.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It makes us healthier? Really?
I think it potentially makes us healthier, particularly from a psychological and emotional point of view, because it gives us that sense of continuity.
There are a lot of buildings that have come and gone, and in Charlotte, we have taken away the Double Door Inn, which was a significant, when you looked at it, it was kind of a rattle-trap old place, but a significant amount of music was played there, and people had fond memories of that. It is gone.
It was a legend.
Right now, we have the Excelsior Club. What to do with the Excelsior Club, and who will save it, if anyone will? I think it's been saved. But people look at that building and go, okay, so it hosted Nat King Cole and maybe Ella Fitzgerald was there, and it was a significant place for black entertainers to come and perform for black people at a time when they had no other options. What does it mean to save that building? What does it mean to the community? What does it mean to Charlotte to save that building?
Mm. Well, I think that a big part of it is that this was a monument for the African American community, and so many communities that were specific to African Americans were lost through our history, especially in the 1960s through redlining and urban renewal projects. We lost whole neighborhoods. The Brooklyn neighborhood is almost entirely gone to history. And so this became a sort of rallying point, I think, for everyone in the community to say, this is still here. This really had international significance. What can we as a community do to save this structure so that we don't lose another monument to our past here in Charlotte?
In 10 seconds, how should it be preserved to respect that history?
As well as it can be. And it's going to be a cost-benefit analysis, and we hope that someone will come forward with a sensitivity to it and the right budget and the right mindset.
Adria Folkt is president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. She's here with Tom Mays with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and we will continue in just a moment at Charlotte Talks.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On the new episode of Southbound, we talk to Paul Feinbaum, the radio and TV host who has become one of the icons of Southern college football. He's got lots of opinions. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about historic preservation, and we're talking about it through the eyes of somebody who lived here, who grew up here, went away, became the chief legal officer and senior counsel for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and the author of Why Old Places Matter, Tom Mays, or Thompson Mays. Which do you prefer? I should have asked.
I go by Tom, but I'm named Thompson because I'm named after my grandmother, who was from Lincoln County. She was a Thompson from Lincoln County.
Okay. And he's with us in our Spirit Square studio, which is a historic building to a certain degree, along with Adria Folkt, who's the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. We mentioned the Excelsior Club a second ago as a place that's finally, I think, been decided we can save this. There's another building in town that we talk about a lot, and the people in Charlotte talk about a lot, and that's the Van Landingham Estate. And I don't know where that stands in terms of its preservation. I know people have been struggling to keep it going for a long time. But what makes a house in an area of town where other houses look just like it significant?
Well, I think that's a big part of what we're talking about with not just preserving historic structures, but preserving historic neighborhoods, because it's not just about the building. It's about that cultural landscape and connecting to, you know, really the entire place itself. So,
So streetscapes.
Streetscapes,
the feeling
cultural
of the
landscapes,
neighborhood.
The feeling of the neighborhood. I mean, that's something that we talk about with our Mad About Modern Home Tour. When we see these fabulous mid-century modern homes that have been preserved and maintained for a modern family, and then the lot next door will have had that same mid-century modern home destroyed, and the larger footprint of the home now has really changed not just the building, but also the footage to the road.
Right.
And you know, it's proximity to other buildings.
Let's talk about that, because mm-hmm. when we talk about gentrification, we usually talk about places that are traditionally have been homes to African Americans, and mm-hmm. suddenly young people come in, they buy the house, they fix it up, and slowly but surely the neighborhood becomes quote unquote gentrified. Mm-hmm. But there are other places that are not like that, that this is happening in Sedgefield, mm-hmm. in Myers Park, Plaza Midwood, where older homes built in the 20s and 30s are suddenly being replaced by brand new homes that fit the character of the neighborhood in terms of the architectural style. But as I said, they are on steroids. They're much bigger, and because they're much bigger, to fit on the lot, they move closer to the street, which satisfies a lot of people who don't want a big yard like they used to want back in the 20s and 30s. What is that doing to these neighborhoods? Should we be doing that to these neighborhoods? I mean, people live different lives today than they lived in the 1930s. We have 15 television sets in the house, and we have computers in the house. They had none of that. They were lucky to have a single radio in the house. So we need more space. We want more space. Our lives are different. So what should we do about that?
Personally, I just say I question whether we really need more space.
Well, we think we do.
So we think we do. I will say that in a place that was carefully designed, where there's a consistent street frontage and the relationship of the houses to the street was designed a certain way, changing that changes the character of the neighborhood. So if old places give a sense of character and distinctiveness, if you start to eat away at that, it begins to diminish that.
Well, let me ask you about this, because there are a couple of new houses going up on Queens Road, which is the stately part of Myers Park. And I remember walking down Queens Road in 1985 thinking, my gosh, these houses are big. These are manorial homes. Mm. Well, the ones that they're knocking down and replacing are castles. I mean, they're even more manorial. So isn't that preserving that was the big neighborhood, where people had money? Isn't it replacing these older, smaller structures that appeared big for the time with bigger structures that are big for our time? Isn't that preserving the character of the neighborhood?
Well, I wouldn't say so. No, I would say it's diminishing the character of the neighborhood by losing the things that old places contribute to the neighborhood, and that is the real character of the neighborhood, not a revised thought about what an individual wants to do right now. So it's almost a disregard for the community value of preserving the entire district or neighborhood.
But tastes change. Desires change. What we think we want, what we like, change. As you know, mid-century modern is just now becoming back into a style that is acceptable. I mean, when we talk about mid-century modern, we're talking about the Dick Van Dyke house, essentially, to give it a television.
Nana's house, as a lot of people say.
Tastes change. What are we to do about this? They don't make any more new land. So what are we to do about this?
Well, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. Yes, tastes change, but almost always there's an opportunity for people who want to build something new, to build something new somewhere else that doesn't actually diminish the character of that historic neighborhood. I have to say, I continue to tell people Myers Park and some of the other neighborhoods in Charlotte are some of the most beautiful neighborhoods in the country. And I think it's deeply sad that the character of those neighborhoods, and particularly the relationship of the houses to the streets and to those magnificent trees and to the sidewalks, is being diminished. So it's almost like individuals come in and they want to take advantage of the beauty and character and distinctiveness of that neighborhood they're moving to. But in taking down the old houses and putting up something that might be out of scale with the rest of the houses, or changes the relationship to the street, it's diminishing the very thing that makes it really beautiful.
We are seeing an explosion of development, particularly commercial development, in certain parts of our area that in the 1980s, you look at South End, and it was a derelict old place with buildings that were not used anymore or falling into a decline because the people were companies were moving out, et cetera. And now it has become a second downtown. It will soon be one downtown, I think, but right now it's a second downtown. And they're doing that by a combination of revitalizing these old places and tearing a lot of them down and putting in buildings that are of a different scale, shall we say. Which is the better? Because it takes a lot of money to upfit a building to modern standards with air conditioning and climate control and lighting and wiring it for computers and Wi-Fi and things like that. You say that it's actually greener to rehab an older structure than it is to take it out and build a new one. Why?
Well, first of all, there's the materials that are in the old building. So they represent a tremendous amount of embodied energy. The way I think of it is those materials that are in the old building have already been quarried or dug and fired and transported and processed and put into the building, sometimes generations ago. Mm-hmm. And taking all of that embodied energy and putting it in a landfill is itself not a green strategy. The National Trust Research and Policy Lab did a report called The Greenest Building. And the catchphrase is, the greenest building is the building that's already built, which is a quote from Carl Elefante, an architect. But they say that it can take from 10 to 80 years for a new building that is 30% more sustainable to recoup the environmental cost of demolition and new construction. Mm-hmm. So all of that material is simply wasted and thrown away. I do believe that the greenest building is the one that's already built. And as much as possible, we should try to honor those materials. The other factor that comes into play a little bit is some of those materials will literally never be available again. Mm. The old growth wood that is in some of those buildings is no longer available. It doesn't exist. If you think about some of the windows in our buildings that may date to the 1920s, the wood in them may be hundreds of years old, actually. And when you tear a building down or throw out the windows, you're throwing away all of that value.
You talk about, among your 14 reasons why preservation matters, you talk about old places functioning to strengthen both individual identity and civic identity. And it's not just preservation, it would seem to me, of homes and commercial buildings. It's other things like statues and monuments. So let's talk about that for a second, because a lot of people who don't want Confederate monuments moved feel that way because to them, those monuments give them not only a sense of place, but a sense of connection to that place and to their ancestors. People don't believe that they believe that, but many people do believe that because I've talked to them. Yet these same objects offend other people for the same reason, because of their historical significance. So what do you suggest doing with artifacts like that? I mean, and if we do away with monuments and memorials to Confederate soldiers, what do we do with the Capitol building in Washington? What do we do with the White House? Both great, built by slaves.
Great, great questions. And first, let me say, the fact that we're talking about this at all emphasizes how important these places actually are to people. These old places matter deeply, and they matter for sometimes different reasons. I include in my book an image of the Confederate Memorial in Cornelius, which was unveiled by one of my grandfather's cousins, one of my cousins, as a little girl. The National Trust has issued a couple of statements about how Confederate statues should be treated in particular, and one before the events in Charlottesville and one after Yep. the events in Charlottesville. And one of the things that we emphasize and that I believe is that we take our history seriously. So we actually think that these statues give us an opportunity to examine the history that they represent more deeply and hopefully more thoughtfully. When the statue in Cornelius was spray painted, I decided I needed to look at the history of that statue. So I went back and read the speech that was delivered when it was unveiled. I will not quote from the speech, but I will say that sitting at my computer, I blushed with shame to read the speech. Mm. And I think it's worth people knowing that history and knowing what was
actually said. So in a situation like that, would it be helpful or harmful to preserve the artifact and put the speech next to it?
I think that would be a very useful suggestion so that people actually know what was said and interpret it in a way that is...
Wouldn't that in turn be offensive to some people?
Well, what I'm trying to get to is the idea that these places can be used to foster dialogue mm-hmm. and a deeper discussion and hopefully civic engagement that leads to... more honest recognition of the history of Jim Crow,
right.
the history of discrimination that they represent, and I you know, my default is always being a preservationist, so I like to save them, but I don't think they can just be saved
right.
without that deeper interpretation and understanding.
And it would be better to, if you're going to save them with the context in the same place as opposed to putting the context in a museum?
Well, sometimes I'm actually fine with removing the statue and putting it in different contexts. So, for instance, this is the example I usually use. And I think these are community decisions that hopefully give this opportunity for deeper engagement around this difficult history and what our past actually represents. But for instance, if you have a Confederate statue in a courthouse where people are expected to pass that statue to go into a civic arena where they're supposed to receive impartial justice, mm-hmm. I have problems with that.
Let me read some things that have come in while we've been talking. Clayton on Facebook is one of the last people to walk through Eastland Mall before it was torn down. I feel that Charlotte needs to build new things with more mindfulness toward incorporating the soul of the old. That kind of folds into your book, I think. Mark emails, how did redlining and segregation contribute to Charlotte's loss of the core city? I'd argue that once leadership decided to keep black, white apart, that the worth of places like Brooklyn was diminished, leaving it isolated and vulnerable. Once separation was in place, the places we gathered together didn't exist. Just like today, we'll never get that back. Well, Brooklyn existed as a residential and business neighborhood until mm-hmm. it was torn down. We didn't move people out and say, well, gee, we don't need this anymore. We got rid of it and the people, too, at the same time,
Absolutely.
Correct? Mm-hmm. John on Facebook, I've always said that Charlotte has a deep sense of architectural history. If a piece of architecture is more than 10 years old, it is history. The Double Door Inn was a classic, and now it's history because it's gone. The awards are tonight. Are they open to the public?
They are. Unfortunately, we are sold out.
Well, that's good news, I suppose. I wish we had time to talk about who was being awarded what and why, but we don't. Adria Folk, President and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. Tom Mays, Chief Legal Officer and Senior Counsel for the National Trust for Historic Preservation and author of Why Old Places Matter, which includes pictures of all over the world and Mecklenburg County. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.